Sourcing Matters Podcast. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman, sharing stories of our food.
And welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman. And today I'm joined again by my good friend and co-host, Nathan Roman. Nathan, how are you?
Doing great, Aaron. How are you?
I'm good. Nathan, did you know it is 2018?
I can't believe it. Like, yeah. 2018, soon the kids are going to graduate and, you know, apocalypse. It's gonna happen real quick.
Those kids that haven't come about yet, but they're soon to come.
One day.
The glimmer in your eye.
Yes.
Well, that's true. And I cannot believe, I was looking at it thinking 2018. I was thinking, well, you know, we've kind of used as a benchmark for so long, 2020, 2 years away. That's pretty.
Can't wait for the flying cars. Yeah.
Yeah. The flying cars and new political regime. Oh yes. Right.
Yes.
Now. And so Nathan, I was actually reading and I wanted to share this cause I thought it was quite interesting. I was reading a report that NOAA put out earlier this week that talked about 2017 was the costliest year on record for U.S. natural disasters.
Yeah.
$306 billion in cumulative dollars. So that's like true cost spent of what has happened around the country based off natural disasters. So, you know, it's crazy, right? That's we're talking about a situation here where it's climate instability, excuse me. And that's a reality. And you know, much of that is to do about our behavior mm-hmm. and our extending footprint.
Right.
Right. But we do, speaking of that regime in 2020, have a different perspective on some of where that comes from. So on that positive
yes.
note, right, there you go. There's a great way to open yes. a conversation. The only thing I was going to say besides that, too, is, do you know, I bit my tongue the other day. Isn't
what?
That crazy? Yeah, I bit my tongue.
What are you, seven?
I know. I'm 43 years old. I have had the same tongue for all 43 years. And I bet it. So if I start swelling up and can't speak.
Oh, okay. That'd be the reason.
There's
okay.
the reason. So there, I got to get out of jail free card. Hey, Nathan, we have a wonderful guest today, and I think he's going to share some knowledge with us on many attributes. It's Bill Nyman. Hey, Bill, how you doing?
Fine, Aaron. Hi, Nathan.
Hi,
good
Bill.
To be with you.
Hey, Bill, let's carry this environmental discussion
yeah.
a little further, actually. I wanted to have you chime in on this. You have quite a bit of experience here in dealing with environmental issues and animals. But what I want to set you up with here is talking about the rains in California. We spoke last and
yeah.
you were sharing with me that the rains are coming and, you know, we're dealing with Arctic blast here in the Northeast and you have a deluge going into, especially into California, Southern California, that followed by a year which has had drought, fires, and now we got this epidemic or issue coming with flooding. So what they were saying is that there's no plant roots now holding the soil up. So the real fear is becoming mudslides. So I want to cue you up with this to say, hey, here's an opportunity for us to think differently about this. And maybe a way that we can think differently about that are related to solution sets where for too long, environmental impact in dealing with food animals constantly gets a bad rap. But the reality is it's not the animals, but it's the production models that we use. So aren't there ways to engage food animals to have a positive net impact on the environment for sequestering and restoring soil? So I'm going to cue you up with that and let you just give us that full sidebar as long as you want. Talk about that, please, and share with us and our listeners.
Okay, well, thanks for that. Just to, in the spirit of full disclosure, we're celebrating 5.25 inches of rain mm-hmm. in the last 24 hours and lots of sun coming to follow it up. So California being a very diverse geographical entity, and some of us are blessed 1 year and some of us not. So in that context, we're celebrating here our local situation, mm-hmm. but I'm very sympathetic to what's happening in large areas and affecting lots of folks. And specific to your question, I'm a strong believer that having large herbivores on the landscape is one way to prevent fires in that they can manage the available forage and reduce the amount of fuel when a fire does occur, which they will. And additionally, having a solid pastoral kind of grass cover, low-growing forbs as opposed to brush and trees, is a really way to maintain not only soil health and sequester carbon, but hold the land in place. So what you're talking about specifically in today's kind of emergency situation and in response to the fires that we've had over the past weeks is that the grasses and other vegetation that was holding the land in place has lost its ability to hold. And then when you have large amounts of rain, several inches over short periods of time, that soil begins to move downhill rapidly. And I don't have the details, maybe you guys do, but I know in Montecito, which is a very luxurious part of Santa Barbara and Santa Barbara County, there were several people that were killed today in mudslides. And that's just one local crisis in response to Mother Nature's wrath. Mm-hmm. So, and most importantly for our conversation, as there was historically throughout the country, large herds of herbivores, grazing animals, ruminants, and in the Great Plains and Midwest, it was the bison, and the far west, it was elk, which served the same purpose of keeping the grass and forage in balance and eliminating much of the fuel for the fire season, as well as keeping the soil in place.
That's fascinating. I've seen before you talk, or like on your site, talking about not only the betterment of, say, the cows and how you treat them and leads to better meat, but also how that improves the soil and soil quality. And you're speaking to how it helps in maybe even reducing the damage from fires. Are there other positive consequences of having good soil quality that impacts the land and earth in general?
Well, certainly all agriculture impacts the land, but plowing and planting has the most negative effects on soil and carbon sequestration and ultimately food production from any unit of measure, whether hectares or acres. So I think what's really exciting to me and what people rarely talk about is that grazing animals, while building soil quality and soil fertility, keeping the soil in place, preventing the catastrophes that we briefly discussed earlier, it also converts all this naturally occurring cellulosic material to wholesome and delicious and wonderful food for human consumption. And that is an incredible thing. So without any inputs, without disturbing soil, and in fact enriching soil through their waste, we are able to produce food off grasslands, which much of our country is made up of grasslands. Mm-hmm. I think it's 55%. Mm-hmm. And these are lands that are in the arid west and Great Plains and are not suitable for corn and soybean or other planted row crops. So here's these wonderful intermediaries between the soil, the sun, whatever moisture we are able to get, between that ecosystem and what we need to really sustain our lives and grow our brains and our young people and B12 and so on that goes with it. Here's this wonderful opportunity to really create this wonderful, wholesome, delicious, essential food for human consumption.
And the thing about it is it's cheaper. It's cheaper to use photosynthesis to create foodstuff for animals that do well and healthier from living on that forage, on that grasslands, than doing an input-intensive corn or soy-based diet, which, it's a perpetual approach that we've taken, and it's gone out of control. But thank goodness we got guys like Bill Nyman who are taking us in the right path. And so, Nathan, let me throw this in there for Bill, too, because this is quite interesting. Bill has obviously been able to make this applicable in action for many years. So a little bit of Bill's background. He was the founder of Nyman Ranch, which if you've ever gotten a burger at Shake Shack, the Nyman Burger, mm-hmm. Nyman Ranch Burger, or gone to any
some
local grocery
stuff,
store. Or BN Ranch stuff, which is associated to some of the better brands. Bill has been out and done advisory work for some of the biggest brands and has truly an influencer in global meat industry. Bill, I'd say you're a pioneer. That's the way I like to phrase it. How's that? A pioneer in investing in animal husbandry and healthy living environments, because you've done it for so long. You're part of that original movement in the Bay Area that focused on elevated production standards. And also, Bill is maybe the, Bill, I'm going to say the lesser half of our power couple of elevated standards. Bill's wife is Nicolette Hahn Nyman, who wrote the book Defending Beef, which is an excellent book and really gets into detail. And Bill's mentioning what has happened. And if I remember correctly, Bill, about 115 years ago, we had something like 10 or 15 million more herbivores on the lands than we even do now. And we're complaining about what the effects of those animals are going to be on the environment or on our health. And again, it returns back to, it's not necessarily the animals, it's the production model that we've adopted or perpetuated to go out of control.
Yeah, so, right. It's, in that context, it's very difficult to blame the few, if you will, large herbivores in the landscape today for global warming. This is something that's been with us for an awful long time and in much greater numbers.
Yeah, that's the narrative that, I mean, as somebody that's not in the industry, that until this very moment, that's the narrative that I've believed. And I didn't know that it's not necessarily the number, but the production model itself.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, Bill, maybe we can go a little deeper into those production models, those elevated standards. And there's a lot of information out there. And I think some of that information may not necessarily be on large herbivores. People know the difference of when they see the when they go to buy eggs and the 10 or 12 different egg options you can get for looking at, well, what does this elevated standard mean? But in especially in beef, there are some standards that have been set. And whether those are grass-fed or grass-finished or no antibiotic ever or pasture-raised, these are things that have been introduced. You've been practicing many of these for years, but many of them have hit the mainstream market. And I think there's a lot of confusion out there. Could you share some knowledge with our listeners about what those really represent for elevated standards and what are the ramifications of those?
Well, first and foremost, the confusion is a key issue. And some of that is driven by marketing people trying to confuse the consumer. Hmm. And others are just driven by people trying to do the right thing and define it and make it easy for people to make decisions based on labeling. Unfortunately, it's a very complex subject and interpreted differently by different folks in different regions. And if you're a farmer or an animal livestock person, you may interpret it one way. And if you're a marketing person, another. And if you're a consumer or customer, you're trying to figure it out and not sure. But you, wanting to be something is not enough to make it happen. So, let me just take it. You know, my focus, my entry into the business was much more in the grain finished arena. Hmm. And as I started in the beef industry, incidentally, I came to the meat industry because I was farming and ranching and needed to add value to what I was doing every day on the farm. And back in 1984, for those of us who can remember that far back, there was a dairy buyout, and the consequences for cattlemen, people who were not raising beef cattle as opposed to dairy cattle, was profound, and our animals were suddenly worth a lot less and way below cost of production. So at that time, myself and partners and people in our community were looking for alternatives, and that's when we began to finish our own cattle and sell them directly to Bay Area customers. At that point, we were talking about natural. Natural meant giving the animals the opportunity to do what they would do in nature, not feeding them man-made compounds to replace good husbandry, and just feeding them what they would eat in nature, or allowing them to eat what they would eat in nature, at least for most of their lives. Then they would be confined for the last 120 to 150 days of their life and fed the harvested, concentrated energy of the plant, grasses, which would be grain. So whether it's wheat or barley or corn, those are all the concentrated energies that you can harvest from grass when they're in season. So that was where I started, and that was the prevailing kind of paradigm in North America, because North America had huge surpluses of grain and could do that, only place in the world where that could occur. But then as I learned more about the raising cattle and the impact of having to plow, plant, harvest, transport, store, dry, the concentrated energy of the plant, it became so much more compelling, and which it happens in much of the pastoral world, to really raise beef cattle on grass only and allow them to do the harvesting. So there's minimal human inputs. So you have sun and water and soil growing grass in grasses and other in legumes and other forages. The cattle can harvest it themselves. And given the time necessary, basically three springs, they will get into the beef can become every bit as good and, in fact, better on an eating quality point of view than the grain-finished beef. And additionally, there's the additional health benefits for those people who are consuming that meat. And more importantly, you don't have to torture animals by confining them and feeding them man-made compounds to keep them alive. And you don't have to torture the environment by plowing, planting, and disturbing the topsoil, which not only does it sequester more carbon and remain more productive that way, but it doesn't go down the Mississippi River to the Gulf of Mexico. So, because that is our nature. That, incidentally, topsoil is our nation's most important resource. And if people would begin to understand that, they could be much more supportive of regenerative agricultural processes, practices, rather than what's going on today in the monocultural areas that land can be plowed and planted.
So, Bill, let's get into that a little bit, because I think it's a key point in soil health or the microbes in the soil or water. We don't even commoditize them. They're not even given a value. They're just there. So we're seeing this as a constant taking of those resources and really just reshuffling them around into confined environments, especially around food, animal agriculture. And I think to Nathan's point, that leads to a bit of a misnomer that, oh, it's the animals, because we're growing all this food. The majority of food is grown to feed animals. And it's because, again, we've perpetuated this broken system. And that broken system, just to add some quantitative numbers to that, Nathan, we process 9 billion animals a year in this country. 9 billion.
9 billion,
yeah. And large animals, specifically beef animals, we process about 34 million. So that's a significant amount. The economic impact of the meat industry on U.S. GDP is $865 billion. That's 6% of GDP that are hit directly from our meat production approach. So these are practices which have perpetuated out of control our large-scale industries. Mm-hmm. So clawing this back and changing it is not as simple. So many of these attributes that Bill's speaking of, without a doubt, just make complete sense. And you start thinking holistically, it is make sense. But Bill, do we have to make this an economic conversation to change back, to get to a point where it's going to change, and whether that's hook or by crook, it's going to change whether we like it or not. So how do we get that? How do we take that change agent and make it proactive? Is it economics? Yeah. Is it health? What do we do?
Yeah. In other words, how do we restore a more sensible agricultural mm-hmm. system to feed people
that's right.
and take care of our environment? That's a really challenging question, and when one major obstacle into creating better practices and better food, let me put to the two obstacles. One is that everything is driven by price today, and buying decisions and production models are really driven by spreadsheet and margin, as opposed to what the right thing to do for the environment, the animals, and the people consuming it. That's one. The other hurdle to get over, and I have an idea of how to do this, but is the concentration. You put some pretty staggering numbers on the industry. What's really staggering or disturbing about that is that 80 to 90% of that commerce is controlled by four companies, actually almost only three. And their doors are not open to many people and many farmers and ranchers that could provide the alternative products and alternative methods that would be much more regenerative and have a long-term benefit for our ability to feed ourselves. So until people understand that buying cheap does not necessarily, it's not really cheap. There are costs that are burdened on, the environment is, costs are being externalized on the environment that, and human public health that we're going to pay for dearly, as not only do we pay it for it yearly, but in the future it's going to be a far greater impact on our economic system and well-being. And until policymakers do something to have the infrastructure of the industry, which is concentrated in a few hands, open those doors and to take care of alternative and more sensible methods of farm production, food production, we are going to continue to go down this slope of destroying soil, destroying the environment, and torturing animals just to keep everything cheap.
Bill, we've seen some signs, some interest that there will be a food revolution. There's potential interest in a local food movement. There's been a lot of engagement in knowing someone's farmer by being able to shake their hand. But what that's lacked is the ability to then scale or to regionalize to make it so that it can compete on cost, but also still not lose those values which the American food system, especially meat production, has surely lost. And I've heard you speak in the past about local versus locale. Could you blend that into part of the conversation of that not every region should be growing tree fruit or should be growing crops or should be growing animals, but we can have a smarter approach around regionalizing certain food stuff and others that we can take a better approach where they might be more applicable, specifically in food animals. Could you share some information about that?
Well, thank you for raising that issue. I think this is critical. Now, as you stated in our thinking, local trumps everything today. And that, although we're very supportive of local farm communities whenever possible, in terms of, you know, cost to the environment and the animals, it's not necessarily the best. And maybe a good example would be if you think about hog production and pork production in the U.S., pigs thrive on corn and soybean or the equivalent. Those things are grown in what we call the Corn Belt in a 10-state area. The corn and soy is there. The pigs are there because of that. Because the pigs are there, there's infrastructure there, and there's all sorts of intellectual capital that's critical to raising good pork in the best way. And it is much more efficient to have the pigs where the feed is rather than ship the feed to the pigs. And this is also true of beef production. Beef should be near the grass if it's going to be grass-fed. And if it's going to be grain-fed, it should be, you know, closer to where the grains are grown. It is much more efficient from any metric, whether you're measuring fossil fuel consumption or the well-being of transporting animals, the environmental consequences, to ship the meat from, in the pork example, from the Corn Belt in the Midwest to the coasts, as opposed to trying to raise pigs locally. And without the infrastructure on the coasts, the cost to the consumer is far greater. They cannot be scaled. There's very little food stuff on the coasts that is suitable for pigs other than byproducts. They should be raised where it makes the most sense. And because the infrastructure is there, the farmer can be paid more appropriately for what he's doing. And all the costs in the middle are reduced and giving the consumer a better value without having to torture the animals or the environment or the farmers. So that we really need to look at that. So when you think about grass-fed beef, there are a few places on the planet that are really best blessed with year-round grass where the animals can be grazing year-round and you don't have to import or harvest or process feed to keep them going through winter months. Northern California, much of that is one of those great areas. Argentina has lots of ground that way. New Zealand, Tasmania, parts of Australia. These are areas where you can raise incredible grass-fed beef, the southeast of the U.S., where you can raise incredible grass-fed beef without having any inputs. Those are the areas where you should raise grass-fed beef because you're following nature, and nature's determining what makes sense in that locale. So we've really got to get people to understand the proper locale and the seasonality of that locale to produce great food with the least impact on the environment and on the animals and the farm community. And of great interest in that, it takes less fossil fuel to raise and process a steer in Tasmania and bring that meat to San Francisco or Philadelphia, for that matter, than it does to get from Omaha to those two locations. Hmm. So when people think food miles, it's not how far it goes, it's how much fossil fuel it takes to move it that mile.
Hmm.
You know, per energy, on some unit of measure, whether it's calories or pounds or however you want to compute that. So please, every locale, every geography has an animal that's best suited to that area. If you're going to be near a large metropolitan area that will drink a lot of fluid milk, you can have a dairy near the town, or you can raise poultry near metro markets because they don't ship and transport as well as red meat, which has improved with age over 30 or 40 days. So there's a sensible application of locale, and when one understands how all this is driven by nature, one can make much better decisions than just buying local. That said, putting a face on your local farmer and being able to buy a farmer's market, if they know what they're doing and the food is good and you're willing to pay more for it, that's something that should be supported.
Yeah.
But it can't be done on a mainstream level and feed millions of people every day.
So we can be pragmatic about our approach, cut out some of the middlemen, and really start to invest in what matters, which are sourcing practices and elevating those production models.
If we want to support proper farming methods and farmers on the landscape, we need to figure out how do we take inefficiencies out between the farm and the plate. I know people are willing to pay farmers to do the right thing by their land and by the environment and practice regenerative methodologies. People are willing to pay for that. They don't want to pay for inefficiencies between the farm and the plate, and they shouldn't have to.
I'm getting, Bill, also there's some redundancies that we can adopt there, too. It's not that it's only Argentina or only Australia that do grass-fed beef. We have plenty of open pasture land that can actually be better cultivated and better farmed, and that's really the opportunity, is to engage differently about where we take our food system, and it's almost a new architecture is needed.
Well, there's a lot of proven methods of the not too distant past. The crop rotation, even in Iowa, which holds 25% of the Class A soil in the world, they had a four-crop rotation. They didn't raise corn and soybean every year and put man-made nitrogen and herbicides and pesticides on every square inch of that ground. They would plant a cover crop, and they would graze animals and raise, a hay crop and a legume, and then they would have a corn and grain crop, and then they would have animals follow. That was a really long-term sustainable model. We just got sideways by these monocultural marketing co-ops and government policies that are really destroying the topsoil of the wealth of this country.
So, Nathan, I had a chance to go visit Bill and Nicolette and their two boys on Bolinas, which is a little piece of heaven, actually, just north of San Francisco.
Sounds like you have
a pretty special place there, Bill. And thank you.
We've been blessed.
Yes. It's wonderful. And during my visit, it was interesting because I'm sitting there, we're sitting at his table, and we're there with the great Ken Kaplan.
And the Righteous Pork Chef, too.
That's right, yes. Which is another book that Nicolette was involved in, or wrote. So we were sitting there, and I'm watching Bill, and he's engaged with his two young sons, and Bill's got a couple of years on me, right, Bill? A couple of years? I hope so
for your sake.
I'm watching him engage with his kids, and I'm just awestruck watching him because he's calm, he's relaxed, I think at the time maybe we were like 5 and 8 or maybe a little younger than that actually, and patience, just exuding patience, listening, conversations, so multiple conversations. I come to learn that earlier that day he had fallen off a hay bale 12 feet down, broke his ribs, so it wasn't just your normal circumstances.
It was a haystack.
I'm sorry, haystack.
The most dangerous place on the farm, right?
And so he cracked the rib and was down, but still exuding patience and listening, and And no problem. I'm sitting there trying to compare myself to this, thinking like how much I'd be flipping out that my kids are there, and you know,
yeah.
And things to be learned by patience. So I just set that little anecdote up there to Bill to say, this is going to take time for us to have a food revolution. This is going to, and you've been living it since, as you said, 84, and mm-hmm. you've been thinking it longer than that.
Yeah.
And so you have learned to deal and to engage with patience and wisdom. So for folks like myself and Nathan and other folks that are listening, that we will get the folks that care about this, that are engaging in a future food system, what do we do? How do we take the proper steps? What wisdom do we need, and how do we develop that type of patience so that the story for your kids and my kids will be different, and we'll have a stable environment, we'll yeah. have healthy food, we'll treat sentient animals properly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if you could share some patience and wisdom with me, I would welcome it.
Yep. Patience will be rewarded. I can only think back how when I started raising animals, actually in the 70s, and we talked about not using antibiotics, and it wasn't a big deal. We didn't think they were necessary, and we were trying to give the animals a chance to live a natural life. And the industry laughed at us, and we talked about no antibiotics, no hormones, and every segment of the industry thought that was a joke. Why would you want to abandon and not utilize these compelling tools to increase production and make money? And now, of course, everybody is saying, if it's not antibiotic-free, you know, it's you're going to have a hard time getting any kind of premium or getting it in the right places. So over time, with patience, if one can advocate for change in sensible practices, they can get traction and they will change the prevailing paradigm. Now, what people need to do, and it's not easy, the people need to educate themselves on what is important to them and why, and how are those things described, and how do you go out and get it? And, you know, the information is at all of our fingertips, and making thoughtful buying decisions starts with, you know, doing a qualitative analysis on every purchase you make and everything you feed yourself, and certainly what you feed your children. So let's figure out what the standard should be and how and where you can get it, and make sure to vote with our food dollars and eat better, eat less, and support the systems that we feel through learning are essential to the well-being of the future generations and the planet.
Well, Bill, I can't thank you enough for joining us on Sourcing Matters. And, you know, I didn't even trip over my own tongue once, so my swollen tongue wasn't so bad. And I did a chewing gum, not even grass-fed beef, but this is terrible.
Well, I hope you'll have me on again so we can continue the conversation we just began.
I look forward to it, Bill. And thank you so much for partaking in the conversation. We look forward to sharing this with all our listeners. And remember, folks, eat well.
Thank you, Aaron and Nathan. Stay warm there.